All right, well, joining me on the line is Robert Wiedemer. He's the president and CEO of the Foresight Group, and he's the author of the Wall Street Journal bestseller Aftershock, Protect Yourself and Profit in Phase 2 of the Next Global Money Meltdown. Bob, it's great to have you on Follow the Money Weekly Radio.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Jerry. It's great to be here.
Over the last week, Bob, I have been seeing, of course, maybe even the last 2 weeks, Treasury bond yields have jumped to their highest levels in almost a year. We've been seeing the yields on the 10-year Treasuries hitting 3.7%. The 30-year yields are hitting about 4.7%, leading some economists to believe that rates are beginning to track even higher over the coming months. And my concern here, Bob, is that the Federal Reserve does not have the will or the foresight to slow their easy money policies and their relentless money printing, which is going to lead to massive inflation. What do you make of the recent moves in the U.S. bond market, and how much faith do you have that the Federal Reserve will react quickly enough to suck out the excess liquidity that they've created?
Well, I think, as you say, the recent moves are partly, obviously, an expectation of inflation. I'm not sure if we won't see a pullback in yields, though, shorter term. But longer term, clearly, you're going to find inflation becomes the overriding factor because, I don't think that the Fed can pull the money back. As one of my friends at the Fed has said, you know, inflation is not something that's forced on you. It is a choice. And the reason we tend to choose inflation is it's the easy out. It's a fairly easy way to try to grow the economy. The other alternatives are not as easy, whether it be taxes or so forth. And so that's why they tend to go into that trap. But as you said, it's hard to, quote, pull the liquidity out once you're doing it, because every time you do that, you're going to slow the economy down, you're going to create problems, and again, there's no easier out at that point. And you have to, of course, pull the inflation trigger back, or the money supply spigot back even harder, making for a much harder pullback than if you just not done it in the first place. So it gets harder and harder to pull it back because you're having to hit the economy harder and harder than if you just never opened the spigot in the first place. A little like a Chinese finger trap. Don't put your finger in it. It will be very difficult to pull back out.
How much do you give credit to the increasing risk appetite that we're seeing in the markets, people pulling money from bonds, moving over towards more riskier assets like stocks? How much of that has to do with the increase in yields that we're seeing?
Well, I think it's a fair amount, in that, you know, fundamentally, if you look at the stock market, when Ben announced that he was going to start printing money August 29th, it's been almost a straight upward, slope since then. So clearly, the movement into stocks is related to the money printing, and I think that's why Ben is very happy about it. He took credit for the market's climb, and I think that's part of what they're trying to do. Of course, again, unless that growth is really based on real economic growth, it's going to fall. And what's always amazing to me is how so many people on Wall Street can fall for this. That, oh gee, they're printing money and they're borrowing money. That's great. The market should go up, but not countering that with what's the obvious downside of it coming later. Clearly, I think that's what's pushing up the market now, but it also means you have an inevitable fall later to come when the inflation hits.
Bob, our books came out about the same time. Your book, Aftershock, came out in 2009, and it brought a lot of clarity to a lot of fears that many people were having. And many of the people who read my book commented that they read your book as well. And what I wanted to ask you about, because many people in our audience have thought about moving into the real estate market, seeing how depressed it has become. Kind of in a catch-22 here, because it appears from several reports that foreclosures are going to continue to happen, especially when we take a look at the latest reports from Q4 of 2010. But the reason it's a catch-22 is because we do see that fixed mortgage rates are going up simultaneously with the bond yields. And so if the idea is that rates go higher, what do you think about real estate right now as an investment? Obviously not in really risky areas, but just as a general investment, what do you think about real estate right now as we are in the very beginning of 2011?
Well, it's an interesting combination of sort of short-term, long-term, in that the short-term, I think that you're going to see bargains, and prices could go down, and you could see even bigger bargains, and I think people are maybe going to jump on those when they can get reasonably low fixed rate mortgages. The problem is longer term. What happens when we were just talking about, Jerry, when that inflation kicks up and interest rates go up? We just did a chart that was basically showing how much a home price has to fall if interest rates go up to, say, 5 or 7, and we're almost at 5, but 7.5 or 10%. And basically, 10%, home prices will have to fall over 50% to maintain the same monthly payment. So the risk here is not so much short term. I think you could find some real nice bargains, and you could lock in a low interest rate 30-year note, but what's the house itself going to be worth? It's going to be a lot less when you have those higher interest rates. So interest rate all over the country real estate all over the country is very sensitive to interest rates, and that, I think, is the bigger risk. Not the next year or two, but 3, 4, 5 years out, as those interest rates really start to climb, not just 1 or 2%, but into that 7% or 10% range we've certainly seen before, can be just devastating to the value of the real estate.
Bob, right now the U.S. stock markets are hitting new highs. There are projections that the U.S. GDP growth could reach as high as 4% this year, and it seems that the fear factor in the markets in general has begun to subside, at least a little bit. So the Fed has accomplished one of its goals, and that was to create the wealth effect. They have certainly been able to buoy the asset prices through their money printing. But my question to you is how much of what we're seeing right now in the markets is a sign of real recovery, and how much of it is just through crafty monetary policy, i.e. the wealth effect? Is it a little bit of both, or what's your take on this?
It's a little bit of that, but let's not forget what it also is. It's not so crafty borrowing. Our borrowing is up about $1.3 trillion from a few years ago, government borrowing, okay? If you look at our economy, it's about, almost $14 trillion. We borrowed almost 10% and shoved that into the economy and helped boost it up. So the real question is, what would this economy look like if you went back to the deficits of only a few years ago? You'd see almost all of that growth gone. And people don't point this out, that almost all of that growth is due to borrowed money by the government, and the government's spending that money. So that's the real problem here. If it was due to true growth in the economy and not borrowed money by the government and the government spending that money, as well as you point out, monetary policy that's been very easy to help boost the stock market and the wealth effect, well, I'd be thrilled. But the reality is that's what's driving it. I'd say even more, frankly, the government borrowed money than the printed money, although the two go hand in hand. Keep in mind, the government would have more trouble borrowing all that money if the Fed wasn't stepping in and printing money to buy a lot of those bonds that I'm not sure we'd be able to sell as easily. In fact, I'm sure we wouldn't if the Fed didn't buy them. So that's what's really driving the economy, is that enormous increase in, which is up 500% from a few years ago, that enormous increase in government borrowing, plus, as you say, the printed money. And yes, a little bit of wealth effect certainly is encouraging some spending. But if it was just that alone and there wasn't that massive increase in borrowing, you wouldn't see the economy turn around anything like it has.
How concerned are you that we're going to see, in the wake of this quantitative easing part two, as they've called it, QE2, another round, as we have really experienced a jobless recovery here? There seems to be lots of signs of life that the government keeps pointing to, but there's still no jobs. We still see a very, very sluggish job market right now. And so how concerned are you that we're going to see this QE2 morph into another QE3 and a possibly QE4? Is that a concern to you?
I'd almost say so far as to be a guarantee. In that I think you will get a QE3 of some sort. It might be along the lines of we'll print money as needed, as the economy is needed. It might not be QE3, or it might be. I don't know, but I can guarantee we'll need to print more money. And the reason is that, we're not getting growth out of the economy. We're simply borrowing money, and we're not, if we don't borrow a lot more, if you really want to get this economy rolling, borrow another $1.5 trillion, meaning a total of $3 trillion a year, and spend it in whatever way the government wants to, and you boost the economy even more. But ultimately, this is going to start to blow up your fundamental economy, isn't it? Especially if we have to buy those bonds with printed money. It's going to create inflation, and we are going to have to do that. That's the problem, is part of what the Fed is doing is making up for the huge amount of spending that the federal government's doing. So it's going to have to keep printing to keep that up. It's going to have to keep printing to keep the stock market up. If it stops printing, that market's going to fall, and if it falls 10% or 15%, where's the floor? And the floor in the past was, it was 6,000 back in March 2009, And the Fed printed massively then to try to pull it back up. Well, you know, it can fall again, but the Fed will have to print massively to bring it up. So you're sort of going into, again, you're going into a Chinese finger trap that it's hard to pull back out. We're going to have to print more money, and that's the bottom line, just to keep the massive borrowing you're doing by the government in some way viable in the current bond markets.
Bob, I've already mentioned your book, Aftershock, but in it you lay out the scenario that you see coming for the U.S. economy, and much of it's already being played out now. You suggested hard assets like gold and silver as a hedge of protection in your book. Talk about some of the asset classes that you like as we head into 2011. And for example, are you still bullish on gold and silver going forward?
Well, I think gold will end up this year positive, and that's partly because I think they will print more money in one way or another come this summer or this fall. And I think that will be positive for gold. I think inflation around the world will help gold. Inflation in China, inflation in India, which are far larger, I shouldn't say far larger, but they're larger purchases of gold in the U.S. So remember, gold's a world market. And if other countries have inflation, people there get scared and run to gold, and in India, China especially. So I think there'll be upward pressure. I don't think it'll repeat the performance of last year, being up almost 30%. But I think it'll end up positive this year. Commodities will continue to do well, agricultural commodities, other hard goods. The only issue I have there is if China's bubble pops, their construction bubble in particular, which is way, way out of control because of a lot of printed money by the Chinese government. Everybody's jumping in on this printed money party. That's going to maybe put some downward pressure in commodities at some point, eventually offset by inflation. But at least in the next year, you're asking, I think commodities are okay, with that little caveat, if that construction bubble in China starts to pop, that could be a bit of a black swan that could take it down. But I don't think that's going to affect gold too much. I think gold will still end up being positive for the year, and we'll hope perhaps a nice 10% gain.
What's your favorite way to gain exposure to commodities when you talk about those? Are you thinking of ETFs for the average Joe on Main Street, or are you actually talking about futures contracts?
Yeah, the money management firm that I work with, we do it through DBA and the commodities and other ETFs like that. Commodities ETFs are, I think, the best way to do it. There are certainly other ways, but for most, your average, and even, your professional money managers, I think they're a very efficient and effective way to trade commodities or ETFs.
Let's talk briefly about global investing. You know, we have seen the growing inflation fears around the globe. We've been hearing it out of India, Indonesia, Thailand, China, of course, as you've already mentioned. And we also see now the unrest that's unfolding in the Middle East. All of this has led basically to a record outflow of money from exchange-traded funds that are invested in emerging markets over the last couple of weeks. So I ask you, Bob, what do you think about emerging markets now? Is now a good time possibly to invest in this dip, or do you think that they have much more to fall before the investor moves back into emerging markets?
I think it's like any bubble. If you looked at the housing bubble in our own country, it sort of had some ups and some downs. It didn't always go straight up. I think this could be a dip that could be followed by some more gains. I think China is the key here. I think emerging markets are driven much more by China than people want to admit, not only psychologically, but in reality, a lot of what Brazil and other emerging market exports is goods or natural resources to China. Korea is the same thing, and so there's a lot of interdependence on China, and I think there's a lot of psychology dependent on China, both. So I think that you could get this bubble to continue to go up this year, but it's not a long-term play. At some point, China's construction bubble will pop. It's not fundamental. It's driven by printed money. It'll pop. Could you play the bubble a little longer? Yes. But it's not long term. You know, make sure if you got into it, capture your gains. Don't spend too long. And again, it's not like the housing bubble. You could have made money there too if you bought in 2004, and you sold bought in 2002, and you sold in 2005. You got to time it. But it's not a long term bubble. But it might have a little bit more to run before it pops, would be my guess.
Well, you've obviously mentioned China, and that seems to be one of the major trends that many people have made a lot of money off of. What are some of your other favorite emerging economies right now? What are some of the emerging markets that you have your eye on, that your firm has their eye on?
Well, I like India. India has an advantage in that a lot of what it exports, at least to the U.S., is services, which are a big cost saver. And an awful lot of companies, as we know, are certainly looking to save on expenses, and outsourcing to India is a good way to do it. I have a friend who works at one company, and he's just traveling the East Coast, just pitching the offshoring jobs off to India. It is a big cost saver. So I think it's still got some legs on it. The only problem with India, of course, is that it's a fairly unstable economy, and they have a lot of infrastructure issues. But I like it, for that reason, and I think it probably has a little more growth to it. Brazil, I'm worried about simply because of its dependence upon China, although it's had, its stock market has certainly shown one of the more impressive gains. China's stock market hasn't done that well. We're at the Shanghai Composite's now about where it was in mid-2009. It's been a more difficult area. So I would be wary of China. It seems like the government's going to start throttling back, already has started throttling back on inflation by increasing its interest rates. I think it'll continue to do that. So India is one to take, a bit of a risk on. Istanbul, if you want to go a little bit way out of line, Turkey has done very well. And they've got a lot of good fundamentals, not quite as dependent upon China and things like that. So that might be another one to look at as well. Turkey, India would both be ones to, I think, would be interesting ones, certainly ones we're looking at. Turkey's growth has actually been almost as good as China's in terms of their GDP.
Well, and Turkey, Bob, brings us very close to the Middle East, which obviously we've talked about the unrest there. There are many investors who are looking for, exotic ways to get into the Middle East. There's just a handful of ETFs right now that invest in the Middle East, and actually those are the more stable Gulf countries. What's your take on investors who are seeking to gain access to the Middle East markets? Do you think that makes a good play over the course of the next decade or so, or are you a bear long-term on the Middle East?
I'm going to be a little more of a bear, and Middle Eastern markets are a little less advanced than the Turkish market, although you're right, it is part of the Middle East. It's a little bit more European in some ways. Middle Eastern markets are more volatile, obviously tied to oil. I think that when China's construction bubble pops, oil will start to have problems in terms of maintaining its price, and ultimately a declining price of oil is clearly going to hurt the Middle East. Now, as I mentioned before, the prices in the U.S. of oil will go up because if our dollar falls at the same time, that's going to increase the cost of all imported goods, including oil. But for the Middle Eastern countries, that sort of world price will go down when China's construction bubble pops, and we start to have more problems as well, and in Europe as well. It's going to reduce demand. So I'm bearish on the Middle East longer term, and certainly some of the high flyers like Dubai have seen a lot of popping in their economies already. So and even the short term in the Middle East, it's tricky to get into. So even though there may be some room left to run in this current bubble, that isn't where I probably put a lot of time. And again, long term, I'm concerned about it, quite concerned.
Now, we talked about metals earlier, but what about silver? I don't think I got your take on silver. What's your thoughts on silver as we go into the rest of this year? Are you bullish on the metal?
I won't say changing my take, but I've been spending more time on silver. Our money management firm, our precious metals are about 75% gold, 25% silver. We're still more bullish on gold long term. I think it's going to be viewed as a great source of value worldwide, more than silver. And silver still has the problem of being almost 50% demanded by industrial use. So it's going to be more vulnerable to any downturns in the economy. That said, just like I mentioned in our own portfolio, I think it's good to have some silver in your part of your portfolio. There's a real chance that silver could break out a bit more because of it being the poor man's gold. It's cheaper to buy. I still would say my long term is that I'd have a little more gold than silver, but I think silver's got a great run. You're certainly going to have a smile on your face in even 2 or 3 years, and certainly in 5 years if you buy silver now. Big smile.
Well, okay, if everything plays out the way you see it over the course of the next several years, kind of give us a breakdown, a timeline, and I don't want to hone you in and force you to predict and break out your crystal ball here, but just give us an idea of what we can expect to see as we go forward, as you outline in your book some of the caveats that you warn investors about and just American consumers in general. Where are we heading? Where do you see this whole thing heading?
Well, this year's not going to be that bad. We have that huge support from the Fed printing money. We have that huge support from the government borrowing even more money this year than last year. That will support the economy. But as you said, the jobs problem isn't just a corporate America problem. It's a construction problem. What drives this economy are service businesses. If you don't see hotels being built, retail shops being built, office buildings being built, the factories of the modern service economy are not being built. You're not going to create those jobs. In construction, again, look anywhere in America at this point, and construction's way down. I live in Washington, D.C., a recession-proof city as they come. Construction has almost fallen flat here. There's some heavily government-funded, but for the most part, it's gone. And if you don't have that construction, you not only lose those construction jobs, as I said, you lose a lot of the service jobs that are created when these buildings are built. So you'll see jobs come back when you see a lot of construction. I don't see construction coming back for a while. So that's the one hole you're going to have going through this year. They'll be hard even for printing and borrowing to offset. Next year, of course, we still have those same stimulus of money, printing and borrowing. But the problem is by next year, people are going to start getting more and more worried about inflation because it's going to start to show. You printed for a long time. You printed a lot of money. We've increased our money supply 300% or 400%. It's going to start to show. And I think inflation is going to be the big issue in 2012. By 2013, you're going to start to have a real problem because, of course, inflation also pushes up the interest rates the U.S. government pays on its debt. Because a lot of our money is short-term that the U.S. government borrows. And when you start to see that going up, people are going to start to figure that we got real problems. I mean, at 10% inflation or 10% interest rates, we're going to consume most of our income taxes paying just interest alone on our government debt. So it's kind of okay this year. Inflation scares next year. But after that, things could get to be a real problem because that inflation is going to be reflected in significantly higher interest rates by 2013.
If that plays out the way you see it, Bob, in the markets, what are some of the sectors of the economy, which industries, in other words, will thrive during that time?
Well, clearly, I'm going to be old-fashioned on this one, and it's been said so many times before, but healthcare is one thing that's going to do as well as anything. Probably, it'll probably do better than most. As we've seen, education's been good, but education's still easier to cut than healthcare. Healthcare we will be cutting it, but fundamentally, the aging population, the fact that you need healthcare a lot, and the system, frankly, is difficult to control costs on healthcare. Also means it's going to grow, and to the detriment of the whole economy. But at least for that sector, that's going to be the best sector, I think, to be in. At least, certainly, for the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, probably even 10 years.
All right. Well, if people would like to learn more about you and your work, how can they do so, Bob?
You can check out our website, aftershockeconomy.com, aftershockeconomy.com, and we've got all of our information there, and you can see our updates. We've got newsletters, and we even do little audio conferences. So there's a lot of ways you can keep up with it, and we also have our updated second edition Aftershock coming out in May. So you can find out more about that as well on the website.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll look forward to having you back on the program soon.
All right. Thanks, Jerry.